those were here last year. Last year we started the Megillah before Purim. We actually did 4 chapters of the Megillah before Purim last year. So I thought we'd pick up this year, chapter 5. For those who were not here last year, were here last year and forgot what we said, so classes are available online. Well, we can do a quick review here, but we'll jump into chapter 5. Just to, I guess, get us back into Megillah's Esther once again. Megillah's Esther contains the story of Purim, which is coming up in 2 weeks from now. And I want to just revisit how one is supposed to view the story of the Megillah. I mean, the story of the Megillah is written...
I'm sorry, this one's Priam.
Oh, yeah?
Called, and she says, "I don't know." But she also says, "Rabbi Breckowitz is going to be speaking at radio at 4 o'clock. So everybody wants to hear Rabbi Breckowitz is going to be speaking at 4 o'clock at radio.
Public service announcement.
I don't know, they'll tell me when the activity rooms are going to be.
Okay.
Anyway, that's great.
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you. So the way we read the Megillah, the purpose of the Megillah, what our message is supposed to be, it's not just a history book. It's not just a story of the holiday. That's not how we look at the Megillah. The word Megillas Esther, it has in it a reference to the word Megala, which is to reveal. Esther, it means hidden. The word Esther is related to the word Soser, which is something hidden. Megillah is Megaleh, which is to reveal. So it's a book which is supposed to reveal to us the hidden. What do I mean by that? There is a concept that God has seen the world in 2 separate ways. There are times where God has what's called Gilui Panim. God is open, available, obvious to all. And there's times of Hester Panim, where God is hidden behind the scenes. Purim, the Megillas Esther, is the time where we see God running the world from behind the scenes. It's a time where the Jews were in exile. It's a time where the Jews had challenges. It's a time where the land of Israel was in ruins. It's a time where there was a decree, genocide against them. And in that situation, in a situation where we did not see God readily, God is there behind the scenes working out the salvation of the Jews. That's the concept of Hester Panim, of God being hidden. Megillah is teaching us how to find God behind the scenes. So it's a historical account. It was an event which happened in the 70 years in between the destruction of the first temple and the rebuilding of the second temple in the Persian Empire. But it's there as a lesson for us for eternity, that even when we don't see God readily in our lives, God is there behind the scenes, moving around the right pieces to bring us in the right direction and save us, and it's all for our benefit. God's name is not mentioned at all in the Megillah, a famous idea. You don't find the name of God anywhere in the Megillah. And that fits into this theme. God is hidden in the Megillah. If you were living in ancient Persia at the time, you would not see God performing great miracles. The sea didn't split. There weren't 10 plagues. There wasn't food falling from the sky. Everything that we find in terms of, let's say, the Exodus from Egypt, where God is performing open miracles, God is obvious, that's all absent in the story of the Megillah. And nowhere in Megillah does it mention God's name. Nowhere. It does not say God's name. But there is a reference to God in the Megillah, which the rabbis tell us, when the king of Achashverosh is referred to by the term the king, that has double meaning. It means the king, Achashverosh, and it means the king of kings. It means God. So if you read the Megillah and you see the term king Achashverosh, that means just Achashverosh. That means the Persian emperor. But if you see the word the king, and it does not say the name Achashverosh there, so there's a double meaning. It means both Achashverosh, that's the simple reading of the Megillah, but on a deeper level, it means the king of all kings. It means God. And those places in the Megillah, that's where, behind the scenes, we can really see God, God's reactions, how God is moving the story to redemption, to salvation. The Vilna Gaon writes, he has a famous commentary to the Megillah, and he writes that every single verse of the Megillah is somehow supposed to show us the magnitude of the miracle. So the details that we see, the different stories we find in the Megillah, the descriptions that are given, they're not just there to create a flowery story or to draw us into an exciting event, but rather it's there to teach us about how great the miracle was. So one perspective of reading the Megillah is to take each verse and understand how this relates to the great miracle of Purim, the great salvation which occurred. Every single verse in the Megillah is supposed to point us in that direction. So that'd be an exercise we can all do, is to take each verse. He actually, in his commentary, he does this. He looks at each verse, he tries to show you how this fits in with the miracle. Many times he'll do that in his commentary. But for us, that's our exercise, to see how is it that this description fits into the greatness of the miracle. One other important point is that the rabbis tell us, based on a verse in the Megillah, that if this applies halachically, Megillah is referred to as an igeres. It's referred to as a letter. I mean, most of the books of the Torah and the Tanakh, we call them svarim, they're books. The Megillah is referred to as a letter, which has halacha ramifications. So for instance, there's a custom, we'll see, when they read the Megillah, they open it and scroll up, and they fold it, and they read it like a letter. So they don't roll it like a Sefer Torah. What they do is that they open the Megillah entirely up, they fold the pages on top of one another, and they kind of read it like they're reading from a letter. That's how they read the Megillah. There's other ramifications in halacha about how it's written, based on the concept it's like a letter, but it's referred to as a letter. So what's the difference between calling it a letter or calling it a book? So a book is something that somebody writes, and the information is there, but it's not speaking personally to you. It's written for the masses, and these are true facts, you know, take them or leave them. That's a book. A letter, I mean, so certainly before the days of junk mail, if you take a letter is written to you. It's addressed, this is for you. This is a special message I have for you, as a lesson for you, as a greeting to you. It's a personal thing, a letter. That's essentially a letter. A book is not personal, a letter is personal. So the Megillah is supposed to be for us, it's addressed to each of us, to train us how to see God in our daily lives. The Megillah is showing you, look, this is where, even when you don't readily see God, God is there behind the scenes, bringing you in the right direction. And it's as if God wrote us a letter. Here, look, read this letter. This is a letter special for you, and it's going to teach us a lesson that the Megillah is a very personal lesson, that God is in our lives day in and day out, behind the scenes, and we don't see Him. So the Megillah should be taken as a very personal lesson rather than just a factual event. That's the idea of it being, one idea of it being a letter, being an igeres. So I think that's just a general perspective of how to view reading the Megillah. And ultimately, on the holiday of Purim, Megillus Esther, I mention this every year, people kind of view it as a kiddie holiday. People view it as a holiday where kids dress up and kids have a good time. We don't always see the depth and the mature adult perspective of Purim. But Purim is an extremely deep holiday. In rabbinic writings, it's really one of the holiest holidays, possibly on par with Yom Kippur, according to Kabbalistic ideas. The holiday of Purim, the rabbis say, even if other holidays will cease to exist, in the future Purim will always exist. Even if other books of the Tanakh may be irrelevant in the future, the book of Esther is always going to be relevant. The rabbis point out that Purim is the eternal message, that Purim is a holiday which is with us for eternity. It's a lesson for us in our daily lives. So Purim, we take the time to learn about Purim and learn about the story of Esther, we'll see that it's much more than a kiddie holiday. It's much more than the costumes and Hamantashen, but it goes a lot further. Obviously, the costumes and Hamantashen fit into the day as well, which, you know, the separate discussion, how each one of them fits into the concept of the day. But we should never view it as a children's holiday. We should view it as a very holy day, a day of tremendous spiritual opportunity and joy. One of the most joyous days of the Jewish calendar, not just because it's wild, but because there's a spiritual depth to it, which is there. So that would just be my introduction to the Megillah. There's always a lot more to discuss, both for Purim and for the Megillah, but, you know, just to pick up from last year, we'll try to learn the Megillah a little bit more in depth, and hopefully from there, it'll hopefully enrich our Purim as Purim comes along. So I handed out copies. We're up to chapter 5 now in the Megillah. I guess it will bring us up to date in the Megillah. I don't have the translation in front of me. I'll use my Hebrew, but you'll see the translation. Hopefully I'll translate someone that can sense there. Yeah, you have something to look on? Yeah, you're okay? Share? Let's make sure I have the same words as you. I never vouch for translations. I got this from Chabad.org, but it's always better than the original. Translations are always many times have to take a certain side in terms of how to translate the words. Hebrew words might have different implications to them. But, you know, for a translation, it seems to be pretty accurate. So we'll use this as a translation. To bring us up to date in the Megillah, we're up to chapter 5. Chapter 1 discussed the Emperor Ahasuerus. Yeah, he was the ruler over the Persian Empire, which at that time was basically the world power. He ruled over just about the entire world. The rabbis point out that his power was really over the entire globe at the time. For all settled nations, really, he was in charge. He was the world power. The Jews all lived in the Persian Empire. They had just been exiled from the land of Israel shortly before the destruction of the first temple. And this is in between the two temple periods right now. The Ahasuerus was a very wealthy king. He was a very... he really enjoyed himself as being the king. He made, you know, elaborate parties, and he had his first wife Vashti killed. We're probably all familiar with the story to some degree, so it starts to bring us back in. His first wife Vashti killed, and he had to find a new wife. In chapter 2, he looks for a new wife. He calls in all of the girls in the kingdom to the palace to try out to be his wife, and he selects this nice Jewish girl named Esther. Esther was raised by her cousin Mordechai. Mordechai was one of the greatest tzaddikim, one of the most righteous people of the times. He was a member of the high court of the Sanhedrin. He was somebody who was well respected by the entire Jewish people. And she was a really, you know, nice Jewish girl. And she was brought into the palace of this Persian emperor as his queen. Her parents, she was orphaned as a child, and she didn't have her own parents. That's why she was raised by Mordechai. She was just orphaned as a child. So that's the introduction to that sets up the story. In the third chapter, Haman, who is at this point an advisor to the king, is promoted to second in command in the land of Persia. Haman hails from the nation of Amalek. As we know, Amalek is the nation which is the antithesis of the Jewish people. In the Torah, we were given a command to annihilate Amalek, eliminate them from existence. Amalek is looked at as a symbol of evil in our world. The Jews are supposed to be the ones who spread goodness and God to the world. Amalek is here to stop that mission. That's how we view them from our perspective. And Haman hailed from that nation, so he had an inherent anti-Semitism to him. We'll see he had a lot of arrogance. And he held himself to be divine at a certain point, had everyone bow down to him. And Ahasuerus, the emperor, agreed everyone should bow down to Haman. Mordechai refused, "I won't bow down to a human being who held himself to be a god." The rabbis tell us it could be he was just aware of idol on his neck as well. So there was idolatry involved in bowing down to Haman. And Mordechai would not do it. So Haman, even though he had, you know, tens of thousands of people all groveling at his feet, and he had the most power in the kingdom besides the emperor, because that one Jew in the corner went down to him, he was outraged. And his arrogance led him to want to destroy the entire Jewish people. He understood that Mordechai didn't bow down because Mordechai was a Jew. And because Mordechai was a Jew, and Jews won't bow down to me, I'm going to destroy every single Jew, man, woman, and child. That was Haman's decree, and he convinced Ahasuerus of it. And they signed and sealed the decree that we're going to destroy the Jews. That was the, I guess that's the intro to what we're up to here in chapter 5. After Mordechai and Esther find out about this decree, so they're very distraught, but Mordechai sees the hand of God here. It's not a coincidence that we have a Jewish girl in the palace right now. And obviously, we don't know God's ways, but we see a sign from God. The fact that there's a Jewish girl in the palace means to us that God is trying to set something up here. We see God at play. And Mordechai convinces Esther that you need to go into Ahasuerus and plead for your people. At this point, Ahasuerus was not aware that Esther was Jewish. She kept that concealed. All he knew was Esther was an orphan girl that was brought in by Mordechai. But she did not know that Esther was actually Jewish. And Esther will only reveal that later on in the story. But for all he knows, Esther was just some orphan being raised by a nice man out in Persia. That's what Ahasuerus knew. Esther was the queen, but yet no one was allowed to enter into the king without being called in. Anyone entered into the king without being called in would have been executed. So for Esther just to walk in on her husband and make a request, she was making herself vulnerable to the death penalty, because nobody walks into the king without being called in. But Mordechai tells her, this is your chance. There's a reason God put you in this place. God has his ways, and if you do not go in, you're not going to be spared either. Trust me, you, your father's house, your people are all going to be annihilated. So this is the chance right now. Go in. You have to risk your life, but go in and save the Jewish people. So Esther said, okay, I'll do it. But I need everybody to repent and fast for 3 days. And only with that I'm ready to enter in to speak to Ahasuerus. So Esther understood that if the Jews are not repenting, if the Jews are not fasting and praying on her behalf, it's not going to succeed. She understood why God has these decrees set up in the world. God allows people like Haman to rise in the world in order to drive us to repent and to return to him. Esther understood, if there's not repentance and not fasting, so then there's nothing I can do can help. So Esther said, I need the entire people to come together, unify, fast for 3 days. That's a lot of fasting, 3 days. Pray, repent, and with that I'll enter into the king. And that's how chapter 4 of the Megillah ends. And she says, and with that, if I'm destroyed, I'm destroyed. But then we've done our best. We have repented. We have done our best to return to God. And now it's in God's hands. So we'll pick up here in chapter 5. That brings us, hopefully, up to date. And the Megillah says, chapter 5, verse 1. On the third day, Esther donned, literally, royalty. Garments of, rather than the translation. She donned royalty. And stood in the inner courtyard of the palace, facing the palace. So Esther now is going to risk her life. The rabbis tell us, when it says she donned royalty, so the simple explanation, she put on her royal garment. She put on her crown, she put on her royal robes as the queen. But the rabbis tell us that royalty can also refer to a divine spirit enveloped her. That as she's entering into Achashverosh, she felt that the divine spirit enveloped her, which helped bring her in and guide her about what to say and what to do. That she put on her Ruach HaKodesh, as the rabbis tell us. She enters in, and if we think back to what we were mentioning before, there's a double meaning to the word the king in the Megillah. So when it says here that she entered into the courtyard of the palace, and we see the king was sitting on his royal throne in the palace, facing the palace entrance. So literally, she was walking in and facing Achashverosh, but also in her prayers, she was there facing God. She was there praying to God at such a depth that she was, you know, looking, as it were, face to face at God in his palace, pleading for her people. So there's double meaning. She's entering into the king Achashverosh, the human king, but also in her prayers, in her mind, in her heart, she's entering into God at the time. The king was sitting on his royal throne in the palace, facing the palace entrance. The Vilna Gaon points out that what was the miracle in this verse? Why was that miraculous? Because usually the king's throne was not at the palace entrance. Usually the king would sit on his throne and he would have some sort of chamber where he would judge the nation. There was some sort of courtroom or chamber of judgment where the king would sit on his throne. Happened to be today, the king chose to sit in the palace, in his, I guess, his living quarters, and he wasn't sitting in his judgment room, which was not usual for the king. And when she entered in, not only was he in the palace at the time, in his living quarters, but he was sitting out the door, facing the door. So she didn't have to walk in and surprise him from behind. She didn't have the guards catch her first. She walked in, and immediately the king saw her standing at the door. So that helped her cause, because she was the king's wife, she was beautiful, and she was able to charm the king. As soon as he got a glimpse of her, he was already kind of charmed by her, and she found grace in his eyes. But had she had to, distract him from the back, or had the guards seen her first, had she had to knock on the door to come in, it could have been that the king wouldn't have been as gracious to her as he was right now. So she walks in, and the king spots her. And we're going to see in verse 2, when the king saw Queen Esther standing in the courtyard, she found favor in his eyes. So immediately, the king was pleased with her. The king extended to Esther the golden scepter that was in his hand. Esther approached and touched the tip of the scepter. So that was the sign of acceptance. So the king says, "Esther, my dear, I see you." He stretches out the scepter, she touches it, and that means she's accepted by the king, and now she can speak with him without being executed. So she's gotten past stage 1. She is not executed by the king, which itself was a tremendous miracle. The Gemara tells us that 3 miracles happened at this point. The Gemara says that there were 3 angels which came to help Esther. What happened? Esther was fasting for 3 days. If you fast for 3 days, it's very difficult to hold yourself steady. She's going in to plea with the emperor over the world at this point, and she has to hold her own, and she can't walk in limp and weak and, pale. So there's an angel that came to help her hold up her head, the Gemara says, because or else she would have collapsed. She hasn't eaten in 3 days. So she's very nervous, I'm sure. She's been intensely praying. So the angel came to help her hold up her head. Secondly, the king's scepter, the Hebrew wording implies this more, you don't see it in English, but the king's scepter was a short scepter. And the Gemara tells us that an angel came and stretched the scepter out to Esther so she could touch it immediately, and the king could not withdraw that acceptance. So the angel came and stretched out the scepter to her so she could touch it. That's the second angel. And then the Gemara says a third angel came, and the wording of the Gemara is that the angel placed a string of kindness upon her, which means the angel gave her a special charm. So even though, yes, it was the king's wife and he found her beautiful, but the angel gave her a special measure of grace, so that the king saw her, he would be extra charmed by her. That also came from the third angel. So 3 different angels came in to perform 3 miracles for her, and obviously that was God's hand involved in helping Esther fulfill her mission. So that is verse 2. So in verse 3, the king says to her, the king said, "What is it, Queen Esther? What is your request? Even if it be half the kingdom, it will be granted you." So the king is very favorable to her. And the king says, "What would you like? Half the kingdom, it's yours." The Gemara tells us that, what did he mean by half the kingdom? It's a funny phrase, "I'll give you half the kingdom." So the Gemara says he was referring to, "I'll give you whatever you want, just don't request the Jews can rebuild the temple. Don't make that request." Why? Because Achashverosh is told, we're told that Achashverosh actually hated the Jews more than Haman. We think Haman, the one who initiated the genocide, he's the big anti-Semite. But the Gemara tells us that the truth is that Achashverosh hated Jews even more than Haman hated Jews. And Achashverosh did not want the temple rebuilt. He said, by no means will I allow the Jews to rebuild their temple. Even if my wife, who I love and has found favor in my eyes, asked me a request, my answer to her is no. I will not help out the Jews in that way. Additionally, he found the temple as a threat to his power. When the Jews are in the temple worshiping God, so the Jews say, who is the power of the world? It's God. We have a central meeting place we all go to. We worship God. We recognize God as the world power. Achashverosh wanted to be the world power. Achashverosh, he built himself a throne that was akin to King Solomon's throne, the rabbis tell us. He was trying to kind of step into the role of a god. He used the temple vessels in his parties. He used to wear the clothing of the high priest because he had this all in his hands, because the Babylonians had conquered Israel and destroyed the temple, and the Persian Empire, they defeated the Babylonian Empire. So everything from Babylonia was in his hands. So he had the temple vessels, he had the priestly garments, and he wanted to make himself, I am the new king, I am the new god, my palace is the temple. Having the Beis HaMikdash rebuilt in Jerusalem was a major threat to his power, and to his ego. So he would not allow that to happen. But he says to her, I'm willing to help you out. Whatever you would like, till half the kingdom, it could be yours. And she says to him, Esther said, verse 4, if it please the king, let the king and Haman come today to the feast that I prepared for him. So she's not yet ready to make the request. She's the simple understanding is that she wanted to kind of encourage him a little bit more, relax him, make him more joyous, make him more favorable towards her. So he wanted to come to a party. I'll invite you to a party, I'll take care of you, get you a little bit drunk, and then I'll make my request. That's what she wanted to do. And trust me, he drank, and he drank a lot, as you can see in the beginning of the Megillah. They had quite lavish parties. So she doesn't feel confident yet to make any requests. But she says, come to my party, and I'll tell you there. The Gemara points out an interesting thing. Why does she want to invite Haman to the party? She was here to request Haman's execution. She wanted to foil Haman's plans. Why would she want him at the party? It's a very strange thing to invite him. Listen, why doesn't she say she should sit down to a nice romantic meal with her husband, serve him some wine, they can enjoy each other's company, and then she'll make a request. But to invite Haman to the party is a very strange thing. So the Gemara gives several reasons as to why she might want Haman at the party. I'm not going to go through them all, but I guess just to give a few. So number one, she had thought that maybe this will be a trap for Haman. We know that Vashti, the queen, at Achashverosh's party, she slipped up and got killed. So maybe having Haman at the party, he'll slip up too and get killed. You know, the king's kind of fickle. He's willing to kill somebody if necessary. So maybe having him around might be a good idea. Just maybe he'll say something wrong and then off with his head. That was maybe one intention he had. Also, she wanted Hashem to see, in terms of her prayers, how low she has to stoop. I have to stoop so low to save the Jewish people that I even have to come and flatter their greatest enemy. When you see a nice Jewish girl having just such a terrible act and flattering an anti-Semite in that way, maybe God's mercy will be aroused and it'll help save the Jews. Also, she thought, if I succeed in my request, I want him to be right there so the king can kill him right away. Because if we have to wait, so maybe the king will change his mind. So if I make my request, the answer is yes, so then it'll be immediately off with his head. But if he has to go and find him somewhere and bring him in, so then, okay, maybe he'll plea a little bit and he'll be able to find favor in the king's eyes, etc. Maybe the king's other advisors will recommend against it. So she wanted him to be available so that if she succeeds in her request, Haman will be killed immediately.
We were talking earlier, he didn't know she was Jewish.
So right.
Why is he telling her, I'll do anything but rebuild the temple, if he didn't know she was Jewish?
Because maybe she's coming in to make a request for the Jews. She's coming for some request.
Okay.
She said, any request you want is fine with me. Just not, don't help those Jews out, though.
Okay. I just thought maybe he suspected she was Jewish or something.
Right. I mean, as a suspicion, it wouldn't be crazy if he suspected it, because she was raised by Mordechai.
Okay.
So it could be suspected it, but she would never tell, and nobody for sure knew.
Okay.
That seems to be clear. Yeah.
At what point does he discover she's Jewish?
Only later on when she requests that Haman be killed. She says, my nation... No, he's threatening my nation. At that point, he knows. So, but it's not until then. Just one other point the Gemara says. It could be that the king would suspect that Haman has taken a liking to Esther. And therefore, the king would kill Haman, thinking there's some sort of affair going on or something. Because look, Esther hasn't been to the party. They talk to each other. They have a very cordial relationship. Because he might get jealous of Haman, suspect Esther and Haman has something, some wrongdoing going on, and might have Elkanah Haman executed for that. That was another possible thought in Esther's mind by inviting Haman to the party. And also one additional point, the commentary of the Malbim, he writes that she went to catch Haman by surprise, so he couldn't defend himself. If she went to Ahasuerus and says, Haman is trying to kill me and my people, so execute him. So then Haman will find out about this when he's being dragged into the palace. He'll think about self-defense. He'll protect himself. If he's sitting right here next to her at the party, he's going to kill me. So then the king says, okay, kill him right on the spot, and Haman will be able to defend himself. That's another point why to have him at the party. So let's move on in the story. But the other reasons given as well. But there's a lot of different possibilities to why Haman was invited to this party. So in verse 5, the king said, tell Haman to hurry and fulfill Esther's bidding. And the king and Haman came to the feast that Esther had prepared. Verse 6, at the wine feast, the king said to Esther, what is your plea? It will be granted to you. What is your request? Even if you have the kingdom, it shall be fulfilled. So again at the party, the king says, okay, Esther, I'm here. You want to have a party? I'm at the party. What do you want to tell me? I'm waiting. I'm waiting to hear what you have to request. There must be something important going on, so I want to hear what it is. So what does Esther say? And so Esther replied in verse 7, and she said, my plea and my request, verse 8, if I have found favor in the king's eyes, if it shall please the king to grant my plea and fulfill my request, let the king and Haman come to the feast I shall prepare for them, and tomorrow I shall fulfill the king's bidding.
What does bidding mean?
Request. Yeah. The request that I should tell them, that you want me to tell you my request. So I'll tell you my request tomorrow at the next party. So she says, I'm not ready to tell you yet. We'll make another party tomorrow. And tomorrow at this other party, I'll tell you my request. So it's very, very strange. What's she delaying for? I mean, the Jews are in jeopardy. You know, she was sent in. Mordechai told her this is the right thing to do. She's been praying, repenting. Why is it that she's delaying it another day? So the Vilna Gaon writes that she wasn't ready to make her request yet. Why? Because she's waiting to see a sign from God that the time was ripe. She knew, as we said, if God is not on board, this is all worthless. My request will not be fulfilled if God's not on board. So she was waiting to see a sign that God is with her. She didn't see that sign yet. We'll see, by the time they had the party tomorrow, there was a sign. But on the first day at the party, there was no sign from God that anything had changed. And she was concerned that God had not yet accepted the repentance, accepted the prayers, and therefore she wasn't comfortable yet making this request. We'll learn about in the next chapter, what was the sign she saw? So that very night, we'll read about chapter 6, Ahasuerus had trouble sleeping, and he thought, maybe I didn't reward somebody who needed to be rewarded, and he found out he owed a reward to Mordechai. And the events turned out that Haman had to lead around Mordechai and honor Mordechai. So there she saw, now I see, Mordechai is being honored, Haman is being ridiculed, now I see that the tables are turning, and now I'm ready to make my request, because I see God is with us. So we'll see that in chapter 6. But Esther was waiting for that sign to come, order for her to make a request. So she wasn't ready until I see a sign from God. And there's in the allusion to it in this verse, she says, if it please the king. The king, again, has a double meaning. The king means, first the king means God. So I want to please the king. I'm not sure if the king of all kings, if God is pleased yet. So therefore, I'm not yet ready to make that request because I don't know if God is with me quite yet. So that's what she's telling him in verse 8. And there's a very deep idea which is embedded here in verse 8, which I want to share with you. She wants to make her request the next day, tomorrow. Rav Yitzhak Hudner, who was the Rosh Yeshiva of Shus Chaim Berlin in Brooklyn, probably passed away, you know, 15, 20 years ago, something like that. He has a whole series of books about all different holidays called Pachad Yitzchak. And in his book on Purim, he writes a very profound concept. He says that Haman, we know, hails from the nation of Amalek. Amalek, as we said, is the symbol of evil in our world. They're the antithesis to what the Jewish people stand for. Amalek was a grandchild of Esav. Yaakov and Esav were brothers. Yaakov is the grandfather of the Jewish people, and Esav is grandfather of Amalek. The rabbis teach us that, you know, Yaakov and Esav were twins, but they're very different. As we know, if you read the Torah, you see that they're very different people, have very different goals in life. And the rabbis kind of frame it is that Esav is somebody who lives for the present, for this world. Yaakov lives for the next world. a Jew is supposed to be living life focused on the next world. I'm focused on eternity. I'm focused on God. I'm a divine. I'm not focused on the here and now. I'm focused on eternity. Esav lives his life. I'm focused on the here and now. Whatever is good for me now, whatever I enjoy now, I do. I don't think about the future. And that itself could be its whole discussion. But that's how the rabbis frame the struggle of Esav and Yaakov. They're struggling over these two worlds. So this world and the next world. The world to come and our world. So Amalek also, in the following in their grandfather's footsteps, so Esau's footsteps, so they're people who said, we live for this world. Forget this whole God business, this whole next world business, this spiritual business. We don't care about that stuff. We care about the here and now, and we try to cloud over any thoughts of eternity, thoughts of godliness, thoughts of eternity. We try to get those out of the world. That's our goal in this world. We don't want to think about eternity. We think about the here and now. And the Jewish people, obviously, we think about the eternal goals for the world. We think about God, and we think about the spiritual realm. We think about performing acts which are going to give us eternal reward. That's how we are supposed to live our lives. So Amalek's place is in the here and now, in the present. That's their place. This world. Esau's place is in this world. And in this world, Esau might succeed, and Amalek might succeed, because they're the ones who have control over our world. The here and now goes to them. And they're the ones who try to teach us about the here and now. Yaakov, his ultimate success is in eternity. Eternally, in the future, the times of Mashiach and onwards, that's when the Jewish people are finally seen to be on top. Everything comes together. We understand that there was an original plan from God. And the Jews are the ones who brought that plan to the world. And they shine the eternal light of God upon the world. So that's a vision of eternity. That's a vision of the future. That's what that is. So the place where we actually are able to defeat Amalek, or Esav, by extension Amalek, that place is going to be in the future. When Yaakov and Esav clash in the Torah, Parshas Vayishlach, so Yaakov says, eventually, I'll meet up with you at Mount Seir. That's Yaakov to Esav. Esav says, come along with me, we'll have a good time together, we'll be friends. Yaakov says, not right now, but eventually I'll come meet you at your mountain, at Mount Seir. So the rabbis tell us, when will that be? That's not going to be in Yaakov's days. That'll be in the future. It says, we say it actually in the morning, in the davening, we say that the saviors will come out to Mount Zion. They'll judge the mountain of Esav. In the future, at the time of our final salvation, Esav is judged. That's when Yaakov meets up on Esav's mountain once again. It's in the future. Our battle, our victory will be the eternal victory. Maybe not here and now, but in the future. So the place where one fights against this force of Amalek has to be not in the today, but in the tomorrow. That's the deep idea which is embedded in this verse. It says when Moshe and Joshua in the parshas of Vashalach, they fight against Amalek too, in the Torah itself. The first battle against Amalek in the Torah. So Moshe tells Joshua, tomorrow, go out and fight Amalek. Tomorrow I'm going to stand on the mountain. So why is he saying we're fighting them tomorrow? Let's fight them today. Because Moshe, again, is alluding to this deep idea that the place, the battle of Amalek has to be a battle in the future. It's a battle of tomorrow versus today. We beat them in the tomorrows, or beat them, not in the today, but in the tomorrow. You have it also, there's another reference to it, I don't have it written down here, also when King David fights against Amalek as well. So he fights them, Mamacharos, on the next day, on the tomorrow. If you find this funny reference, every time we fight against Amalek, it's always tomorrow. We always find them tomorrow. Every time you see them appear on the Torah, it's always tomorrow. In the Purim story, so Esther tells Achashverosh, I want to make my request to you tomorrow, because I'm trying to request to defeat Haman, who hails from Amalek. And even at the end of the Megillah, we'll see that when the Jews are fighting against their enemies, so Esther requests, I need to have one more day to fight them. I want to fight them again tomorrow. That's what she tells Achashverosh, because Esther understands this deep concept that, and this is, again, it's a very deep concept that's alluded to in the Megillah, but the point is that we are people who live for tomorrow. The enemies that we're fighting against the Megillah are people who live for today. So our victory is going to be in the tomorrow, not in the today. And the lesson for Jews, the lesson we can take out of it, the practical lesson, is that the way that a Jew lives life, we're not always focused. The here and now, things can be difficult. Unfortunately, in history, we've seen the Jewish people in the here and now a lot of times have to struggle. But we know that there'll be a tomorrow. The tomorrow will come, and in that tomorrow we will be victorious. That's what we always know. There will be a time, there will be a final salvation, there will be peace, there will be recognition of God and recognition of God's Torah in the world. We don't see it yet today, but we will see it, God willing, tomorrow. We'll see it in the future. And that's the lesson we should always take from the idea of today and tomorrow. So the very deep reference that Esther is making here, I want to make my request to you tomorrow, so can we refer to this very deep concept, that the place to fight against Haman's in the tomorrow, not in the today. That's what she's saying. Let's go back into the Megillah, verse 9. So that day, Haman left happy and content. But when Haman saw Mordechai at the king's gate, and Mordechai neither rose nor trembled before him, Haman was filled with wrath against Mordechai. So you see, you also see the arrogance again of Haman. He left high on himself. He was invited to a party of the king and queen, just himself and the king and queen. He thought he was on top of the world. He sees one Jew not bowing, everyone else is bowing down to him, groveling at his feet. He finds one Jew not bowing to him, and he's outraged. His wrath was filled against Mordechai. That's just the ego, the arrogance a person can have. So Haman at this point thought that now I'm ready to kill out Mordechai. I want to do it immediately. Because Haman until this point was concerned that, you know, I know that Esther was raised by Mordechai. So Esther's the queen. And if I kill Mordechai, I'm going to be in big trouble. I can't kill the king's adopted parents. I mean, I can't do that. But now Esther saw, we just had a party. I mean, Haman saw. We just had a party. Esther didn't invite Mordechai to the party. She invited only me. So I see now that Esther doesn't care so much about Mordechai, and Esther cares more about me than Mordechai. Now I'll kill Mordechai. Now I'm comfortable killing out Mordechai. I'm not worried about the backlash from the palace. That's what he says. So at this point, he goes home. He's very upset. He says, verse 10 says he restrained himself. He didn't want to do it without the king's permission. He wasn't worried about the queen anymore. But you don't kill someone without asking the king, at least. So he had to ask the king first. So he restrained him. He held himself back not to kill Mordechai on the spot. He went home. Went to his house and sent for his friends and his wife Zeresh. He called for his wife and his friends to chat with. And in verse 11 it says, Haman told him of his glorious wealth and his many sons and all about how the king had promoted and raised him above all the king's ministers and servants. He starts bragging about how powerful he was, how wealthy he was. And then Haman said, in addition, along with the king, Queen Esther invited only me to the feast she prepared. Tomorrow too, invited to the feast along with the king. So he's showing, I'm on the top of the world, I'm great, I'm wealthy, I'm powerful. It's me with the king and queen, untouchable. But then he says in verse 13, yet all this is worthless to me. Whenever I see Mordechai the Jew sitting at the king's gate, it's unbelievable. It's worthless to him. He said, I don't care how much power, how much wealth, how much fame I have, that one Jew is driving me crazy. You know, you see the arrogance you see, it's kind of like a maniacal type of attitude towards, which anti-Semites have sometimes. It doesn't matter what they have, but that Jew, you know, yeah.
Does this imply that all the other Jews are bowing down?
Yeah, it does imply that. It does imply that. It could be that Mordechai sat at the king's gate. It could be he noticed Mordechai more often. It could be other Jews in the kingdom would not have bowed down. But of all the Jews that Haman saw, Mordechai was the one that stuck out to him. But that's correct. That's a correct inference. So the, but you know, it's reminiscent of, let's say, talk about someone like Hitler, Yimach Shemo. Hitler is somebody, he was fighting a world war, but yet he's willing to divert resources from the war to kill Jews. He was losing the war. But yet he's willing to spend, you know, probably millions and millions of dollars and manpower just to kill out Jews, even though it affected his military victory. You know, because anti-Semites, sometimes they can just get so crazy. You know, it's not logical anymore. It doesn't make sense. Why would he want to go deal with this one Jew? He has everything you can ask for right now. But, you know, this Jew bothering me, I can't deal with it. I want to kill him, and I want to kill out his people. That's it. You do find similarities between Haman, Hitler, Megillah, and the story of the Holocaust. Not for now, but there are many different, you know, references which people have made back and forth to show that there is some connection between these two radical anti-Semites. Let's just finish up the chapter, verse 14. Verse 14, it says, then his wife Zeresh and all his friends said to him, have gallows erected 50 cubits high. A cubit is approximately 2 feet, so it's about 100 feet high, pretty high gallows. And tomorrow tell the king to have Mordechai hanged on it. Then you'll be able to go in good spirits with the king to the feast. Haman was pleased with the idea and erected the gallows. So Haman thinks, I'll take care of this before the party tomorrow. He made the gallows on the spot. Before I go to the party tomorrow, Mordechai will be dead on the gallows. That's what Haman thought. And he created these gallows. Now, the custom is that at the end of this chapter, the one who reads the Megillah, he kind of ends it on a joyous note. If you listen to a very careful Balkore, when they read the Megillah, they end each chapter a little bit differently. Some chapters that end on a joyous note, they end on a joyous note. Some they end on a very sad note. Some they end on a very neutral note. So So for instance, when the decree was made against the Jews, so the chapter, I think chapter 3, ends in the same tune as Lamentations, Eicha on Tisha B'Av, it goes. That's a very sad and mournful tune. Chapter 4, I believe, ends with a, also I think on a very sad note, if I remember correctly. But chapter 5 ends on a happier note. It's a much more happy tune, because this same gallows erected to kill Mordechai are used to kill Haman. So we already see here the miracles already in the works.
And we don't know that.
We don't know that yet, but we do know that because we know the story. But yeah, if we were standing there, we don't know that yet. You know, so
we know.
We know that, right? But, no, but an onlooker here would think a tragedy is about to occur. An onlooker sees a Holocaust about to happen. That's what the Jews, a Jews living in Persia at the time, at this moment, see. There's about a Holocaust about to occur. That's what they see. They don't know that these gallows are going to kill their enemy. They don't know that yet. They know that there's a decree to annihilate every single Jew, and they know that their leader Mordechai is about to be hanged on gallows by Haman. That's what they can see right now. The one miraculous part of these gallows, he made them so tall, 100 feet high. I mean, why do you make them so tall? So Haman made them so tall because of his arrogance. He says, I want to see this guy wherever I will. I want to see those gallows and see this guy hanging on those gallows wherever I am in the city, because I hate that guy so much. That was Haman and his arrogance. But commentaries point out that there was a miracle involved here as well. Because later on in the story, when Esther finally points out Haman's trying to kill me, and Ahasuerus doesn't know what to do, so one of the servants, who was actually in cahoots with Haman initially, tells Ahasuerus, look, see those gallows? Go hang Haman on those gallows over there. So he says, great idea. So because the gallows were visible, that means that this idea was able to, you know, he had a very quick thinking. Okay, look at those gallows, go put them on the gallows right now. So that actually contributed to Haman's death. And the fact they were so high allowed this advisor to point out to Ahasuerus immediately, see that over there, go put him on those gallows. And he said, okay, go for it. That was it. And he was hanging on those exact gallows. So the fact he put them so high, he did it because he was so arrogant and he wanted to see his enemy hanging. But that led eventually to his immediate death, because those gallows were pointed out immediately to the king, and the king said, okay, Haman, on those gallows right now. So that's the end of chapter 5. So God willing, next week we'll do chapter 6, and where we'll see Esther finally making her plea. Or at least, chapter 6 doesn't make her plea yet. Chapter 6 has the story before the next party. So we'll see that next week, God willing.